You're listening to Vatican Radio. The pastoral challenges of promoting dialogue with Islam as an integral part of the Church's mission is the focus of a three-day meeting that concludes in London on Friday under the auspices of the CCEE, or Council of European Bishops' Conferences. Catholic experts from across Europe have been exploring the question of religious identity and discussing how to integrate interfaith dialogue with the promotion of their Christian faith. To find out more, I spoke with the interfaith advisor to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, Katharina Smith-Muller, who says there is a growing awareness of how dialogue and evangelisation can work together for the good of all the different faith communities.
I think what is emerging is that there is not necessarily a tension between the two. We have looked at the Vatican document Dialogue and Proclamation, which makes the point that interreligious dialogue is always a part of the mission of the Church as well, without necessarily wanting to convert in the process. That there can be two different things, but both part of proclamation. And we had a very interesting meeting with Bernice Vasi yesterday, who is the first female Muslim minister, who has really brought a lot of her own experience, her own lovely experience, into the debate. And I think that was quite intriguing to see and fed into the afternoon session that we had at the beginning of the conference, where we had a Catholic priest here from England speaking. His name is Father Phil Sumner, and he does a lot of work in Oldham. And his point was very much that when we strengthen Muslim and Christian identity, we actually do both communities a favour, and we can work together to do that. So across minorities, the experience is that identity work is the one thing that you can do to keep minority young people engaged and in education, because all of them are confronted with a school system where their identity and the achievements of the communities they identify with aren't necessarily given enough credit. So they're confronted with a school system that has a canon that doesn't reflect immigration experience, that doesn't reflect Muslim experience, that doesn't necessarily reflect Black Caribbean experience. And his experience is very much that if that is integrated into the curriculum, and he's doing some very practical on the groundwork on that, as soon as you integrate that into the curriculum, achievement rises and identification rises. So again and again, the point that we do a favor to the religious voice as a whole and to religious people as a whole if we're strengthening each identity and take each identity seriously.
Would you say that the situation there in Britain is perhaps a model for other countries?
I think we're incredibly lucky, actually, in England. And obviously, my personal experience is mostly of London, and a lot of people will get their first impression of England through London, so the capital. And I think we're very lucky in having a lot of different communities. And it's another thing we noted at this meeting, that yes, there are differences within the Muslim community, and it's hard to find someone who speaks for Muslims as a whole. But then we face that same issue within Christianity. So I think it's quite a learning experience to have all these different communities within communities, and to actually see that maybe no one can speak wholly for all Christians, all Muslims. And I think it leads to a greater readiness to acknowledge difference. I think that is true, because there's no feeling of there's one community and there is the other community. So there's no binary position that could cause tensions. But yeah, there's a mix of lots of different identities. And I think that situation does help. And I think the situation of being very used to immigration, having worldwide links with the Commonwealth, is also something that helps the British experience. I do think that is true, yes.
You're gathered there with mainly bishops representing the different European countries, and yet the majority of your work, as I understand it, is very much at grassroots level within the Islamic and Christian community or Catholic community there in the UK, in London particularly. Do you think the relations between leaders, Muslim and Christian or Catholic leaders, is more important than the work that goes on at grassroots?
I would be really hesitant to say that one is more important than the other. I think they're both feed off each other, ideally. We're very lucky in that we have leaders in the Catholic Church, beginning with Pope Francis and down to our English bishops, who are very open to dialogue, very supportive of the work of dialogue. And I think that that has a, does have a model function. People see that, that Pope Francis speaks of friendship with Muslims. And I think that will be something that Catholics on the ground hear and that, that will get them thinking and get them inspired. And that a lot of the groundworkers of interreligious dialogue have been delighted to hear him say. And similarly, everything that is said at a leadership level has to find an open ear and has to be practiced on the grassroots level. So I don't think one level could exist without the other. And I think ideally, and I think we are getting towards that situation at the very least, they feed off each other and they energise each other, hopefully.
You're painting a very positive picture, Catalina. We also hear some very concerned voices about radicalisation, particularly of young Muslims in European countries today. How do you respond to that?
I think, again, we're looking at young people who are looking, who are searching for an identity. And it's almost the definition of a young person to that they're moving towards finding their own identity. And I think we have a huge responsibility for all young people of faith to not let a vacuum exist into which extremism can go, into which all too easy constructs of identity or faith can come that, that might be potentially harmful. I think we as the mainstream voices, and I'm talking about Christianity as much about Islam, we have a real responsibility to engage with these young people, to make sure that we speak to them in a language that makes them realize faith is something that is relevant to their lives, so that we don't leave them as easy prey for extremists. And that goes for both communities, really.
Do you feel there is a growing radicalization, extremist perspective of the Catholic Church, of the Christian identity as well?
I think there's always the danger of extremism. If people aren't engaged, if people feel they're not being spoken to in their language, there's always a danger of ideas that are too simple arising in people's minds. If you focus on strengthening people in all their complexity with all their different identities, you're not going to get radicalized people because they're strong. You know, it's the old image of the bridge which ties in beautifully with the image of the Pope as a bridge builder, that you need two very, very firm foundations on either side before you can build a bridge.
You've been involved, haven't you, in some very grassroots projects there. Can you give us perhaps just a couple of examples of models which you have seen work very well in promoting this dialogue between the two communities?
Yeah, I think we're very lucky to have Bishop Paul with us here, Bishop Paul Hendricks, who is the Christian co-chair for the Christian Muslim Forum. And he's been involved in quite a lot of the work that the forum has been doing. And part of that work is bringing together women from both communities and just giving them a chance to share a platform to see where their concerns lie on a day-to-day basis. And very soon, I think you see that women share very basic concerns. You know, how do I bring up my child in a society that might not share the same faith or might not share the same commitment to my faith? Or it might just be neighborhood issues, you know, so we all worry about getting our children into the right school. And I think it's starting there, making people recognize that we're all facing the same challenges. And once people start seeing that, I think a lot follows from that, and shared action follows from that, also theological questions, but also a sort of solidarity that is also spiritual, where people start praying for each other and share concerns and ask each other for prayer. And I think that's really beautiful as an experience.
Creating conditions of dialogue or ameliorating conditions for dialogue have to be two things that we always keep on the agenda. And I think maybe a meeting like this just makes people hopeful again.
Monsignor Peter Fleetwood also advises the Catholic Bishops Conference of England and Wales and is a consultant to the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. He says the picture of Muslim-Christian relations varies greatly in the different European countries.
We've got countries from Albania to Norway, Turkey and all sorts of places, and the variety is enormous. I was in the French-speaking group for discussions, and even there, people's perceptions of identity were fabulously different, really. So there's no generic answer, although people often give generalized answers, and that's probably a big mistake. You know, so in some cases, identities are proudness or pride in being different, In some cases, there's a great pride in belonging to a social group. And then there's at a very privileged level, there's a pride in the content of the religious experience, which one shares because one's part of a group. It's at all different levels and in all different ways people speak of their own identities. And the way those identities can survive and grow, it just seems to differ enormously in different countries.
We hear a lot about the fear of a radicalization of these identities, particularly referred to Muslim communities in some countries, and this is very much exploited at a political level. Is there much discussion of these problems at your meeting?
I think they're very much lurking behind many of the themes people have raised. The sociologist from Louvain in Belgium seems to regard some of the extremist tendencies on the Muslim side as a tiny minority, but that doesn't mean in any way that a tiny minority doesn't have a huge effect. The Salafist Muslims really are a tiny minority. Very few people speak of Sufis or Shiites in Europe. There's a huge Sunni community. Sometimes Shiites are themselves afraid of being identified as such, apparently, in public, because there are so many divisions between Muslims. So the groups that come to people's attention seem to be tiny minorities, but who somehow gain enormous notoriety and in some cases win following from disaffected younger people in different countries. We know that ourselves from what happened here in Great Britain a few years ago.
And of course, it's back very much in the news again in the wake of the Boston marathon bombing, referring to the United States. But these things can be very badly exploited, in a sense, can't they, by the political leaders in European countries as well?
Yeah, what's on the agenda here is much less about the political intent of people, but inevitably the political abuse of divisions and frustrations and feelings of difference is problematic. What we're talking about is the origin of the feelings of whether I belong to a Muslim group or a Muslim tradition or to the whole Ummah of Islam or just to my local mosque. All those different forms and levels of belonging are what we're discussing here, and the same in Christianity. You know, it's very interesting to sit with cardinals who are delighted to have been at a meeting of 24,000 people who belong to a movement that is itself, if I'm allowed to say so, a splinter group within the Catholic tradition. You know, belonging can mean different things. Belonging can mean a great pride in being different from others, and that can give rise to a feeling of superiority over others. And those things become divisive within the community. But then when it's a question of feeling disaffected with society, then you have the things that start to interest political leaders and political operators and journalists.
It's also true that Europe, most countries in Europe, have been going through a fairly severe economic crisis for the past few years. And this also tends to exacerbate, doesn't it, the tensions between different communities and exacerbate this sense of identity.
Yeah, I think one of the speakers introduced a novel concept to me, but probably is a very useful one. A feeling of relative frustration. Nobody minds actually living in a housing estate on the outskirts of Paris until someone's neighbour comes along with a posh car or wearing extra special clothes. Then the feeling of relative lack of privilege suddenly pops out of the woodwork. It had been hidden when everybody was the same. We know that in housing estates in my own city of Liverpool, somebody who suddenly sprouts a Range Rover and puts a Rococo arch at his front door, it's pretty clear where he's getting his money from. It's probably a drug dealer. But that's where people take to radical solutions of their own poverty in a very depressing situation. Other people then become very angry and they start understanding that their situation is not so good. And religion often seems to be used by some people as a gathering tool, a flag, to get people together to complain, protest movements against society. And when you can point to the decadence, the moral decadence of a whole group of people, you then feel superior. And there is a kind of tendency to say, let's sort this out. And some people's idea of sorting it out is not by conversion, of soul and conversion of morals, but by violent, even lethal solutions.
What kind of solutions are you looking at there to these problems? You're looking back to the sources, the roots perhaps of these tensions. Most bishops' conference now have a department or experts who deal with the question of dialogue. What kind of perhaps proposals are coming out of this meeting there?
Well, in the groups of people I've been speaking to so far, it's very interesting how clear people are that we must distinguish between external belonging and external factors and internal convictions. And even when you manage to gather a lot of people together and make them feel they belong to something worth belonging to, that's not in itself enough. There has to be a certain amount of helping people to recognize what's going to change them internally. Not just, was it nice to be together with thousands of other young people at the Papal, the World Youth Day, but did it change me? Has it made me happier? Has it made me, given me joy? Is there anything I can share at that level? When you think of the political questions, they all tend to be about what are really conditions, external conditions on our life, rather than the internal effects of changes in society or changes in my own appreciation of the world around me might have on me.
What will you be doing at the conclusion of the meeting? Will you be coming up with some kind of summary, some kind of proposals as to how to move forward, how to improve this understanding, this intent for dialogue between the Christian and Muslim communities?
I don't think there'll be anything radically new. I don't think we're here to solve problems so much as to understand the situation, although what's happened here, which is one of the benefits of these international meetings, is that people have slipped into the conversation things that they do or things that they're aware of. So the best practice in other countries suddenly becomes known to the rest of us. And that itself is a fabulous gain in these circumstances. And I think, for example, the dialogue forums that they have in Belgium or similar things in other countries, those may well prove to be models that could be transported to other places.
To conclude, let's hear from one of the bishops taking part in the three-day meeting. Bishop George Frendo is Auxiliary Bishop of Tirana, the capital of Albania, which he told me is a model for Christian-Muslim relations.
Fortunately, in Albania, religion has never been monopolized by politicians. And perhaps this is the main reason why interreligious relations present no difficulty in Albania. In fact, we have collaborated on certain issues, and for the main feasts of the Muslim religion, we Catholics and Orthodox go to greet them for the Bayram and the other main feasts. So also on their part, for Christmas and for Easter, they come to greet us. And moreover, well, we invite each other for special occasions. For example, just a couple of weeks ago, they laid the foundation stone of the mosque, the new mosque that they are going to build in Tirana. We went. And so also, we last week, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of Pope John Paul's visit to Albania. And the day came too for this occasion. That is to say, we show our friendship in several different ways.
You say that religion has never been monopolized by the politicians, but all religion was outlawed, wasn't it, under the atheist, under the communist regime for many decades?
Oh, yes, it was. It was. And especially the Catholic Church. Especially the Catholic Church, because the dictator had the particular hatred towards the Vatican. He was a paranoid personality, and he always considered Catholics as being spies of the Vatican. And in one of his discourses, in fact, he said that his struggle against religion was quite smooth, with the exception of the Catholic Church, which presented more difficulties. As a matter of fact, Catholics made no compromise at all with the communist regime. And this was the reason why so many Catholics were martyred, many priests were tortured and killed. Yeah, he was much more severe with the Catholic Church. After the fall of communism, there was a certain thirst for religions, or for all religions. And this provided us, different religions, with the opportunity to collaborate for the revival of the religious faith.
What can you tell us specifically about the Muslim community there in Albania today?
Well, yes, it is indigenous, and that is why, in fact, Islam in Albania is very tolerant. There's no fanaticism that you find in so many other European countries. But after the fall of communism, there were, in fact, several who were granted scholarships in, for example, Saudi Arabia and in other mainly Muslim countries. However, so far, these extreme tendencies have always been controlled. And the leaders of the different religions, whether Christians or Muslims, have been always very keen to maintain peace between religions and to control extreme tendencies.
My thanks there to Auxiliary Bishop George Frendo of Tirana in Albania. And earlier you heard Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, consultor to the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, and Katharina Smith-Muller, interfaith advisor to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales.